On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Rainy June morning, 1937. The final preparations are made. In the next 40 days, Amelia and her expert navigator, Fred Noonan, will fly three quarters of the way around the world. On the final leg of the flight, with little more than 7,000 miles to go, she will vanish over the mid-Pacific without a trace.
He grew up watching In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, and someday wanting to search for Amelia Earhart himself. Fast forward to present day, and he's doing just that. An archaeologist with Tiger and an Emmy Award winner for Indie in the 60s, Gary Quigg has a fascinating backstory and an area of expertise that makes him an incredible asset to the Chasing Earhart project. For episode 23 of the podcast, Gary chats with us about how Amelia came into his life, the work that Tiger continues to do on Nikku, and gives us his professional thoughts on Amelia Earhart's flight and legacy.
Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is Gary Quigg. He's a member of Tiger. He's an archaeologist. He's an award-winning Emmy award-winning producer. He's a man of many hats, but we're very happy to have him. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Okay, so just a quick backstory for everybody that's listening. We actually did this interview once before a couple of months ago, and we had some weather issues, so we're kind of repeating it. So Gary's kind enough to do this a second time. But I'm going to ask you the same couple questions to start off the interview, and then we'll kind of veer a different way. Can you tell us a little bit about your education, your professional background?
Yeah, it actually started off with an undergrad in radio, television, film, and pursued that career path for maybe 10 years. And even since a kid, I had always had a keen interest in history and a real love for aviation, but I just didn't see any money in it, frankly. And I was doing pretty well in the communications world. And it just hit me late 20s that I wasn't at all happy with what I was doing. And so I redirected the career path and simultaneously began a master's program in public history, which would allow me to do both history and archaeology. And then started off with a position in a local museum. And from there, things kind of went very smoothly. And then I thought, well, that's great on the history side, but what about archaeology? What about aviation? And this is back before the internet was really even anything. I happened to be reading Flying Magazine, and there was a one-column ad that said, "The International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery wants you." And they had an 800 phone number. They were talking about an organization that was interested in not recovering aircraft to restore them and fly them, which nothing wrong with that. But I always was concerned about what about the historic airplanes that we can learn something from in their original integrity.
Sure.
Tiger was a group that was doing that, so called the phone number. Rick Gillespie answered the phone, became a member in, I think, 1990, and pretty much got hooked. And then from that point forward, became a part of the Earhart Project team, been to the island of Nikumaroro 6 times now on expeditions, ultimately became a deputy project archaeologist, archaeological work not only on the island, but then back in the U.S., I became involved with archaeological projects, and so built my archaeology resume along with my history resume, and then also always stayed involved tightly with the Tiger Group.
And, you know, it's interesting. You have a really really interesting background in tying archaeology and history together. What drew you to that? That seems like just such a fun career path to take. What draws you into that kind of a career path?
Yeah, a lot of selfishness. It's just something that, you know, here's what I would really love to do. I'm not sure I can make money at it or earn a living at it, because traditionally they're not really well-paying fields, either one. But it's one of those things where I've always believed if you have a passion for what you really want to do, and it was clear to me in my late 20s, I really wanted to do hands-on history. And I really wanted to do hands-on archaeology. The excavations, what appealed to me, not so much the academic side, but certainly the research side and the science side. And I just worked towards those end. It was a little selfish, but at the same time, when you're following your dream, if you will, you're going to do good work because you love what you do.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We have a lot of young folks who follow the project, and I want to take a little sidebar about it because we have a lot of folks who are interested in archaeology in that same field that you're doing, that you've chosen and done as a career. You touched on it a little bit, but what advice would you give those young folks out there that want to do something in archaeology that maybe grew up in the 80s and watching Indiana Jones and all those fantastical ideas of archaeology, but they actually kind of want to turn this into a real life career, but they may think sort of what you thought, that, you know, can I make money at this? Is this a real quote unquote career? What advice would you give young kids that are kind of looking into that?
I would really explore, first of all, whether or not it's really something they think they want to do. If they have that kind of conviction that they'd really like to try hard and persevere to make it work, in addition, obviously, to the educational track that they're going to need to prepare themselves for a college degree, specifically in the sciences of, you know, archaeology, anthropology, the best thing they can do beyond that is become a volunteer. And fortunately, just about every state has a Department of Historic Preservation and Archaeology. They're required by federal law to ensure that our archaeological and historical resources are protected and preserved. And each one of those state programs has a volunteer program. That would be my first piece of advice, is contact that organization, this Department of Historic Preservation Archaeology in your state, and find out what volunteer opportunities do they have. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have any currently available, I'm certain they're going to have a list of organizations that are in your state that will allow you that same opportunity to become a volunteer, even as a teenager. I mean, you know, even, you know, under 18, you can still volunteer under adult supervision. And it would be certainly a great way to get your foot in the door, so to speak, start to learn the language of archaeology, start to meet the people who are involved, and build a resume early as a volunteer. And ultimately, volunteer positions almost always will lead to a paid position. And from there, once you have an entry-level position, you can continue doing volunteer work, perhaps doing paid work and building your degree as well. So that would be my best avenue, I would suggest, to anyone interested in archaeology.
So there you go, kids. That's right from someone who's doing it right now. So people who are listening to this podcast, I would take Gary's advice and look into that. Now let's get into Earhart. Now you have one of the neatest stories of how you got involved with Amelia Earhart and how Amelia Earhart initially came into your life. You told us on the first go around when we did the original podcast, and I'd like you to repeat that story because I think it's just really cool. It's a real full circle story. Can you tell us how Amelia Earhart came into your life initially?
Yeah, I mean, this actually goes way back. I was 12 years old at the time, and I was watching a television show that was popular at the time called In Search Of. Mm-hmm. It was hosted by Leonard Nimoy, whom we all know as Mr. Spock in the original Star Trek television series. So Leonard Nimoy was the host of this show, and every week on the show, he was going to a different location following a mystery that everyone was familiar with, be it the Titanic or the Loch Ness Monster. And this particular week, I was watching the show, and he was in search of Amelia Earhart. I didn't really know much about Amelia. I knew who she was. I knew she had disappeared. I didn't really know much about her accomplishments. But watching that program, 30 minutes long, by the end of it, I just said to myself, when I grow up, I'm going to go look for Amelia Earhart. Now, I'd always been kind of a geeky kid into history and archaeology, even as a kid, just reading all that I could and trying to gather as much knowledge as I could, just a personal interest. And of course, as time goes on, you go to school, you go to college, you get your first job, and those early dreams so often fall by the wayside. And we remember when you wanted to go look for Amelia Earhart? Well, I'm just one of those cases that it just stuck with me. And knowing that I still had the passion for history and archaeology and began to build my career in that area, the thought occurred to me, how might I be involved in the actual scientific and historical pursuit to answer the question, what happened to Amelia Earhart? Fortunately, it just so happened that Archaeological Aviation Group that I joined as a volunteer, TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, had an Earhart project, and once I proved my worth to them, they decided to invite me to be a part of that process.
So this is a case of destiny, really. And this is one of the reasons why I love that story so much. And, you know, you're among a handful of folks in the project that have just really unique stories about how they came into Earhart. Can I ask you to speculate a little bit about, you know, that show, the In Search Of show, really sort of, I guess, was the spark that kind of lit the fire for you to kind of, you know, that kind of stayed with you all those years as you grew up, and then now you come full circle. What do you think it was about that show, or about that, the way they presented it, the way they laid it out, that just kind of instantly attracted you to the Amelia Earhart story?
I'm always a fan of good writing, and I think they had some excellent writers. I don't know who their staff was, but the writers had the ability to tell a story clearly and with a hook that kept you in the storyline all the way through the 30-minute program. It added a bit of suspense. Certainly every program was a sense of mystery, and then it left you wanting more. And I think those three things really helped inspire me into thinking, you know, I might just have a shot at helping out, at least being a contributing team member of actually solving what's now become like the number one mystery left from the 20th century. We found the Titanic. So what else is left in terms of the big issue, the big question that no one seems to have the answer to so far?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was chatting with Andrew McKenna a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him this question. I want to pose it to you. I just want to start out bluntly by asking you, is Amelia Earhart, is the Lockheed Electra, the flying laboratory, is that really the holy grail of aviation?
I think that's fair. I really do. It's certainly the holy grail of aviation of the unknown. Let's put it that way. I mean, everyone has a favorite airplane or a favorite pilot or a favorite aviation story, but among the unknown questions, I would put that at the top of the list as the holy grail of, you know, what happened to Amelia Earhart. I think that's a fair assessment. And I think that's one of the reasons that we keep trying to attain the question and the answer to the question.
So you sort of touched on, give an overview of what TIGER does and sort of what they stand for. Can you dive in a little bit to the actual hypothesis for Gardner/Nikumoro now at this point, and that island, and how Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan ended up on that island, and what you folks think happened?
Sure. We call it the Nikumoro hypothesis, right. And we try to keep it as simple as possible. And any hypothesis is just a question that any scientist or archaeologist is trying to answer. So what we believe the hypothesis is that Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were flying on their last flight around the world, and they're getting close to Howland Island, which is their intended destination, where they want to land, refuel, and fly onto Hawaii, and eventually complete the trip to California. At some point, something went terribly wrong. There are a number of ideas put forth as to what may have happened, but obviously she did not land at Howland Island.
Right.
However, we do have evidence that leads us to the island of Nikumoro. And the first piece of evidence is her last transmission, which most people still don't realize. Her last transmission was heard loud and clear by the USS Coast Guard cutter Itasca, who was stationed at Howland Island specifically to help Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan find their way there and land. So the radio operators aboard the Itasca heard this last signal at signal strength 5, which to them means loud and clear within 100 miles. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, Amelia Earhart did not land there. What she says is, we are on 157337, we are running online. She's given us a course, 157 to the northwest, 157 to the southeast, 337 to the northwest. So she's on this line trying to find Howland Island. Well, she doesn't find Howland, she has options. She can continue northwest on 337 from Howland and not find anything but open ocean. If she does continue to the southeast following 157, there are other islands that she may be able to make a forced landing upon. So that's piece number one. Piece number two is, for whatever reason, we continued to hear transmissions from Amelia Earhart several days after they should have stopped. For 3 days, in fact, on her assigned frequency, there were a number of radio transmissions that had been documented that were heard for several days following her disappearance on July 2nd, 1937. Number three is, not only did we have these radio transmissions, but we have radio frequency bearings that were taken from other radio stations in the Pacific. Basically, they're tuning into her frequency and they have a needle that will point to the source of the transmission. Right. And those come from Hawaii, those come from Wake Island, those come from Guam, they come from the Itasca itself. And all of those radio stations had needles pointing to what was then known as Howland Island, today known as Nikumaroro. So there's the next piece of evidence. Okay, we have these source of transmissions here. Let's see if there's anything left. Is this really where Earhart and Noonan are? So the U.S. Navy sends the battleship Colorado from Pearl Harbor down to check out the source of transmission. It turns out that there were three aircraft on board the battleship Colorado. They were observation aircraft, so they were flying on the way down to Howland Island, Nikumaroro, and then they did actually arrive there and flew over the island at about 800 feet. They couldn't get too close to the ground because of so many seabirds around the island. Didn't want a bird strike. And the senior aviator that flies over the island that we believe Earhart and Noonan may have landed on says, here, signs of recent habitation were clearly visible, but after repeated circling and zooming, we failed to elicit an answering wave, so we assumed no one was there. Gotcha. So they didn't see an airplane. They saw signs of recent habitation on an island that was uninhabited at the time, but the Navy did not know that. They had a large area of open ocean to search, so they checked out the island. They didn't know what to make of it. They had to continue on. They did not land. They did not investigate. So what we think has happened with the Nikumaroro hypothesis is Earhart and Noonan did make a forced landing on Nikumaroro. They probably survived there for some time. We don't know how long, but perhaps time enough to set up some sort of a castaway camp. We continue to find archaeological evidence that someone was living there who most likely was not of the Pacific culture. And eventually, with no fresh water on Nikumaroro, and the only freshwater source being rainwater, they succumbed to dehydration and died sometime after this crash landing. So that's the hypothesis, is this is where we think they ended up. Now let's see if we can find evidence that supports that conclusion.
Okay, so that's pretty cut and dry. What I want to ask you now is just about hypothesis work in general from an archaeological standpoint. When you guys hit this island for the first time and you kind of have this idea, this is where we think she may have ended up. Typically, you know, from science, you know, high school science class and a lot of that stuff we've all taken part of, hypothesis 101 typically is, if you have this idea or this thought, you have to sort of work backwards and reverse engineer and kind of try to prove to yourself that it couldn't be any other option besides what you believe it is. So you basically eliminate everything off the table until you believe that your hypothesis is there. What has that process been like for you guys? I mean, I know it's been 28 years you guys have been working the island. I mean, it's baby steps, because you have to go, you know, you can only go for so long. How has that process worked for Tiger in general, as far as kind of eliminating things? Okay, we find some stuff on the island. Could it be anybody else's besides Earhart? How does that work for you guys?
We're fortunate that everyone that I know and have worked with in Tiger are really our own worst critics. And we're also fortunate that we're all very skeptical people. So the first thing with any new potential piece of evidence is that, okay, well, as you say, what are the other possible explanations? Right. And so we spend a lot of time doing that, you know, discounting, well, you know, this could be the source of colonization, which occurred a couple of years after Earhart and Noonan may have arrived on the island. Is this possible that this came as a part of that culture? If we can't eliminate it, no matter what the piece of evidence is, then it becomes a nagging question. You know, we don't have anything that we can say diagnostically, conclusively fits the Amelia Earhart disappearance hypothesis on Nick Mororo. Right. What we have are a large number of pieces of evidence that are considered to be corroborating, that are, you know, considered to be, you could build a case, let's say, with the number of artifacts that we have that don't seem to fit anything else except the Earhart and Noonan flight. And yet we can't tell you, here's the smoking gun, here's the diagnostic artifact, here's what we like to refer to as the any idiot artifact that would prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, this is indeed the last resting place of Earhart and Noonan. So we always take that hypothesis to heart that you mentioned, you know, we all learn about in high school. I mean, yeah, that's kind of the foundation of any hypothesis, and always continue to try to poke holes in it and knock it down. It's just very persistent and nagging and won't let us go.
Yeah, you know, I was interviewing Robert Wheeler, who wrote a book, Amelia Betrayed. It's a really good book, and we interviewed him a couple episodes ago, and he mentioned something I thought was really interesting. He said, you know, they had been researching, him and his partner, the author who wrote the book, had been researching Amelia for several years, and they had mentioned that, you know, a good hypothesis is really like a living and breathing thing. It evolves as you go through. And I think Tiger's a concrete example of that, because you guys have been working this island for so long. Is it important? Can you echo Robert's statement about that? Is it important as far as, you know, being, you mentioned skeptics, your own worst kind of skeptics, to kind of tear apart your own hypothesis as you go along and kind of build upon it and change things? I mean, has the hypothesis itself, at least the foundational one, has it evolved in the last 28 years, or has it pretty much stayed the same statically and then little things have kind of changed along the way?
It continues to change every year, sometimes monthly, based on new evidence that occurs either historically or archaeologically, or we have something that we found years ago that we understand, oh, now I know what this is and how this fits. So it is indeed a living, breathing hypothesis. The worst thing you can do is fall in love with your hypothesis. Yeah. And you can't become, you know, a purported person about this is the answer. I don't think any of us feel that way. I certainly hope not. We try to continually make this thing, you know, I guess, live on its own as it seems to have a life of its own. One example that I can give you is the last trip I was on was in 2015, and there was part of the hypothesis was, well, okay, if indeed Earhart and Noonan landed here, we believe they landed in this area only because the reef flat seems to be more susceptible to landing that could be survivable. And all right, if that's the case, then they're not going to stay inside the airplane if it's intact, because it's 110 degrees and it's an aluminum airplane, so it's a baking oven, basically. So then they're going to go ashore, and we postulate that perhaps they're going to have a survival camp temporarily near the aircraft where they can keep an eye on it and then make radio transmissions, if indeed that's what they're doing, at the appropriate times when they can actually run the engine to charge the generator to run the radio. Well, we searched high and low for evidence of a survivor's camp, if you will, in that particular area, and found zero, absolutely nothing. Not only did we find that, we found that it's a very, very uncomfortable place to try to live and try to set up camp. And so it's not a place you want to spend any time. That it's the heat, obviously, everywhere on the island is difficult, but this particular area doesn't have much of a breeze. And so you really don't want to stay there if you don't have to. So that was one idea that was examined. It was the Camp Zero hypothesis. I think we can now move on from that and try to look for something new that might fit. So that's, I think, one example of how, you know, we have this idea, maybe this fits the hypothesis, maybe it doesn't. And then I think we've been able to eliminate that as a part of the process.
So I want to go backtrack a little bit back to the actual landing on Nicomora or Gardner at the time. Do you think, have you guys speculated that it was an intentional, I mean, obviously they wanted to land, of course, they had no choice, but do you think it was an intentional spot to try to hit that island? Do you think they were kind of aiming for that island as a plan B, or do you think that was sort of a shot in the dark that they were just going to go that way because maybe Noonan knew that, hey, there's islands out here, you know, the chances of us hitting something are better than hitting nothing, as you mentioned, hitting just nothing but water. Was Nicomora, was that a plan B, or was that a shot in the dark, do you think, that they ended up there?
I think it was a plan B that we want to find somewhere to put down because obviously we're not a seaplane. We can't survive if we make a crash landing on the ocean. I do not think they had particularly Gardner Island in mind, but as they followed the line of position to the southeast, perhaps the other islands came in view. One thing that's really, that's actually amplified, it's pretty close to 157 that direction. I think it's Baker Island and McKean, Baker Island and McKean Island are equally close to that position. But for whatever reason, that's not where any evidence has been found that may support the Earhart disappearance. Maybe it was overflown at a time when there was some cloud cover that may have been obscured. Maybe from the distance they were looking at and the angle, it didn't look like a friendly place to try to put an airplane down. McKean Island, pretty obviously, in fact, the Tiger expedition back in 89 actually examined that island, and it turns out it's a really bad place to land an airplane. So hopefully that was able to be determined from the air on July 2nd, 1937. And I think it's a matter of, at this point, okay, here's an island that might be a possibility. We feel comfortable about a forced landing here. And frankly, we're getting low on fuel, so we don't have a whole lot of other options. This is land, and it may be the best opportunity that we have.
Yeah, you don't. I don't think at that point you play around, you chance it. Because at that point,
and you know, you also have to think about the decision-making process of two human beings who have been flying for over 20 hours. You know, maybe it wasn't the best opportunity, but it was the opportunity they selected to commit to.
You know, I thought something was really interesting. I know you need touched on a little bit. The search was obviously massive. They spent something like $6 million in the middle of the Great Depression to search for Amelia Earhart. I mean, it was a ridiculously huge search. And it's a speculation question, of course, but do you think if I've often wondered why they didn't put any ground crews down on the islands. I know they couldn't get there. It was kind of a tight landing and everything, and they didn't want to risk any more people's lives. But do you think if they would have put a ground crew down on Gardner Island at the time, Nicomoro now, that they would have found Earhart? I mean, do you think that we'd be having a totally different history, would have been rewritten at that point?
Well, that's a possibility. I wouldn't give it a very high percentage of success, even if those aviators from the Colorado had managed to land somehow in the lagoon and start searching the island. And I say that because having been on the island in an area that the primary Pacific Airways go nowhere near Nicomororo, Gardner Island, the shipping lanes don't go near Gardner Island, Nicomororo. So when we were out there doing archaeology, we heard an airplane. And that's something we shouldn't have heard. Mm. So we're in the bush. It's a very dense jungle on this island. And we hear an airplane. Well, we're all aviation enthusiasts in addition to volunteer archaeologists and historians. We want to see an airplane. Cool. What's flying out here where it shouldn't be? It doesn't make sense. So we have machetes with us. We have the tools to get through dense jungle. And we're bashing our way out to the shoreline because we can't see above us because of the canopy. And we finally get out to the shore. And by the time we get out there, the plane is long gone. So we couldn't help but wonder, is this what happened on July 9th, 1937, when the airplanes from the Colorado flew over Gardner Island, Nicomororo? Were Amelia and Fred available to see this aircraft? Did they see this aircraft? Could they make themselves known? Could they even get out to see the airplane in time? We don't know. We do know they're dealing with a very difficult environment. We've experienced ourselves. We had plenty of provisions. We had plenty of fresh water, and they didn't. Or are they simply not in a condition, or are they no longer alive a week after spending time on that island? So to say, gee, would it be changing history if the Colorado aviators had, in fact, landed and had the opportunity to find them? There's no guarantee they would have found them. The other thing is, it looks like a very tiny island. If you look at, you know, Google Earth, it's only like 3.5 miles long and 1.5 miles wide. It's got a big lagoon in the middle. You would think, no problem. We can circumnavigate this thing and surely find, if there's only two people on this island, we can surely find them. And we've been trying for years to find good evidence. And it's a huge place. It's very difficult. Without the proper tools to clear the vegetation to get through and to stay oriented, without oftentimes seeing the sun, it's really a challenge.
You know, you mentioned something interesting. I think we're going to segue into that. And it's, I want to talk about morale, because you had mentioned, you know, if they had landed there, maybe, you know, you kind of gave your own example, is maybe they couldn't get out to where they could be visible in time. What do you think, you know, there's obviously speculation as to whether or not, you know, Mr. Noonan was survived much, you know, long at all once they got to the island, because if he had had a fatal injury, potentially fatal injury, they had limited supplies, she probably couldn't have treated it. So let's hypothetically state that Noonan dies and maybe she's alone on this island for a few, 4 or 5 days or a week or whatever it ends up being. What does that do to someone's morale? I mean, Amelia Earhart, I mean, obviously she had a way of conquering fear. She did, if she feared something, she certainly didn't show it, but she's all alone on this island at this point, possibly without Fred. And, you know, you mentioned a great, idea about maybe a plane flying over and she couldn't get out in time to do it, or maybe she was too weak. What does that do to someone's morale? And what do you think, can you speculate on what maybe she might've been thinking? I mean, if that's even possible, what does that do to someone? You've been on the island, it's just like you would know. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. I, the best thing that I can try to do to put myself in the mindset is to think about, you know, and you mentioned that Fred Noonan may have been injured on the crash landing. There are some radio transmissions that apparently said something like that. It's unclear if he may have been hurt in the landing, perhaps badly hurt in the landing, as you say. And let's make the presumption that he does expire, Amelia's alone. Right. So now you don't have a partner to share with. And we learned from all of television's very popular survival shows that are currently on, survival is in the mind. It's really a mindset first. And if you do not have that, you will not survive. You have to will yourself mentally that, yes, I can do this. And yes, I can find whatever it takes to make this happen. So it's truly a mental game.
Yeah.
But you also have to wrestle with the fact that, okay, I've been attempting, if we believe the Nicomararo hypothesis, I've been attempting to communicate. I've been communicating for 3 days on my transmission at particular intervals during the day. I think I've made myself known if there's anyone out there. And so I'm waiting for my rescue to come in hopes that someone has heard those transmissions. So we have all talked a great deal about this, and if we believe we have made communication in 1937, what's the most likely scenario of a rescue? We believe it would be a ship coming across the horizon. I don't think Amelia would have expected an airplane. I mean, this is a very remote area of the world even today, particularly in 1937. And there was really only one airplane in the world that could fly around the world. That was Amelia Earhart's. Now, sure, you have carrier-based Navy aircraft, but why would they necessarily be in that part of the Pacific? And she maybe isn't even thinking that there's this huge search going on. She's thinking maybe she's made communication. But to get to your point, to see perhaps this aircraft or aircrafts flying away and realizing this is my chance, this is my hope that I've been clinging to, they're writing this island off, they may not come again, has to have been particularly devastating to the mindset if you're experiencing that.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I wonder if she felt at that point, if she was indeed on that island at that point and she was alive, if she felt that was sort of it, you know, that was it. They flew by. I mean, I would imagine that there might be a little spark of hope. Well, if they flew by once, they're going to fly by a few times. Maybe I can get out there. But once she realizes, hey, they're not coming back. They're probably never coming back. That's gotta be, I mean, I can't imagine that feeling that you must feel, especially if you're no longer have your partner who was with you. That's gotta be devastating.
And as you mentioned, you know, she has no survival training. She's in a foreign land. She may as well be on another planet. You know, here's a lady who grew up in the United States in the 1930s, on the East Coast for the most part, very different than the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you know, where there's just nothing there except what you can get in the surf and what you can find on land. And you have no guarantee of knowing, okay, if I eat this, is that okay? Or is this going to make me sick or worse? Yeah. So you always have those things playing in your mind. I mentioned earlier the castaway camp that we think may be associated with the disappearance. Whoever was there was surviving on little reef fish that you can catch in the reef pools at low tide, and little turtles that are pretty easy to catch, and birds, which, because they have no fear of humans on the island, there are no humans on the island. Even today, you can walk up to a bird if you really wanted to and have it for dinner and just grab it. Wow. But in talking with the people who came to the island a couple of years later and lived there for 25 years, the Gilbertese people who settled the island as a colony, I've had a chance to interview the survivors, and they said, no, that's, I asked them about, you know, well, what kind of fish did you eat? You know, and then I asked them, well, what about, you know, these little reef fish? And no, we did, we, you know, we're mariners, you know, we have a fine Pacific tradition. We can go out and we get the good stuff. You know, they don't bother with the reef fish, and they certainly don't want to kill little turtles because they want the big turtles to come ashore so they can have a feast. And then the birds, I even asked them as well. I said, well, what kind of birds did you eat? And then the birds that were in the castaway camp, the remains and the bones, didn't fit the same type of birds that these Pacific Islanders were fond of. So whomever was there was not familiar with traditional Pacific lifeways. I mean, that's one thing I think we can say quite certainly.
So you guys have been doing this for 28 years, as we've talked about a little bit in this conversation. What keeps you guys as a team effort? What keeps you guys going back to that island? What motivates and what drives Tiger to keep continuing to find new ways to go back to the island and to find new techniques and things to employ to kind of broaden the search? What's the motivating factor there?
I think it's primarily a desire to answer the question, the Nicomoro hypothesis poses, and the fact that this particular environment continues to provide more artifacts and related areas to this island provide more archival documents that support the hypothesis. And thus far, we haven't found enough of either in any other location to answer this question. So I guess what keeps us going back is this appears to be the best place to answer the question. So let's pursue it to the best of our abilities for as long as possible until we either answer the question or come to a point where we've tried everything we could possibly conceive. But of course, we always believe that, well, you know, there's always the next generation. So just because you think you have it, you've done everything you possibly could. The nice thing about human beings is we all have different ways of thinking and different ways to pose a question and different questions. And so we remain hopeful whether or not this happens in the next couple of decades or not.
And earlier in the conversation, you talked about building a case. And with Chasing Earhart, what we're trying to do is it's almost like a jury trial case. We're getting everybody's expertise and opinions and thoughts and putting it out there for the court of public opinion in this case. Building a case, like building a house, obviously you have to build, you know, brick by brick on the houses to have a foundation, to have an ultimate structure. In this case, Tiger's been building a house for years, and you guys have been kind of getting pieces of evidence. You know, admittedly circumstantial evidence, but it's building. And what I'm wondering and what I want to ask you is, if this thing ended tomorrow and the island sank into the water tomorrow and it could not be explored anymore, are you personally, from your standpoint, happy with the case that Tiger has built over the course of the last pushing 30 years now? And do you think that if it was kind of a court of law case and you guys are able to kind of present this in that manner, that you could convince a jury that this is indeed what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, case closed?
I think personally that I'm satisfied primarily with the work that has been done, that we followed a good ethical framework in terms of our historical research, as well as some pretty rigid scientific work in archaeology to ensure that if we're going to do this, you know, let's do it right. And then let's do it so that it can be reviewed by peers in both professions. And let's take the questions, let's take the criticism. If the island sank in to the ocean, which it's not too far-fetched that it may indeed do, it's 12 feet above sea level at its highest point, then I think we can be proud of what we have done. But I'm a real stickler with answering the question. I'm never going to say, yes, this is the answer to the riddle of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan until we have a diagnostic artifact until we have DNA that matches one of the two individuals. If we have to let it go, then obviously we must. But nonetheless, I continue to hope that there will be a final answer, if you will. I'm not going to walk away and say that there is a final answer now. I can only say that we're on the right track. I feel we've been doing good work. And if that's all we have accomplished, then let's leave that for those who follow to work with.
And if you guys end up finding that smoking gun piece of evidence, or at least a really concrete bombshell piece of evidence, how do you think, Tiger will feel from as a team? And then of course your personal opinion, and do you think you'll feel vindicated at that point that all this work for the last three decades pretty much has paid off and you guys can finally sort of sit back and be like, look, this is it, guys. I mean, this is what happened.
I think that there'll be a sense of peace, because there's a lot of unrest when you work on a project like this, because you have to take the work seriously, but you don't want to take yourself seriously. So there's a balance there. And I think that certainly the pressure would be off, a certain sense of, as you say, vindication. But for me, and I think a number of others feel the same way, it's not about Tiger finding Amelia Earhart. It's about finding Amelia Earhart. And I don't really care who answers the question or whether or not it's even on Newcomb Aurora. You know, the ultimate question is simply, let's answer this, because it's a question that deserves to be answered. We have decided as a culture, this person is important. This person's memory is important. This person still inspires young people. Let's at least bring some closure to this. And that, I think, would be perhaps most satisfying of all.
And you've segued beautifully into our last question. And that is, what is it about this case and about Amelia Earhart in general that just grabs the attention of essentially the entire planet? 80 years is the 80th anniversary of her disappearance, as we both, of course, know. What is it about Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, this case, this disappearance? People go missing all the time, but this is essentially the greatest cold case in the last couple centuries. What is it about this case that just continues to grab people like you from an archaeological standpoint, young folks who latch onto Amelia Earhart in many different ways, as you teased a little bit there? What is it about this case? What's the it factor?
I would like to think that we as human beings try not to accept that things disappear without a trace. I would like to think that, myself included, I believe that nothing disappears without a trace. Plus, you add to that the character of Amelia Earhart as we know it, the persona that we have come to know. Here's a young woman who is doing things that few people are doing, not just few female adults are doing at the time, but few people are doing. And I would like to think that this thing that hooks us to Amelia and Fred Noonan were that, you know, they were out there, man, and they had nobody really but themselves. And they are trying to accomplish something that would make this place a better world, perhaps improve communication, perhaps improve airways, but simply prove that we as human beings can make this world a bit more connected than it is today. And I like to think that's maybe where this all comes from. Hey, they were given it a shot. The least we can do is find them as a part of a memory, an homage to them, and perhaps a tribute that would last, hopefully, forever.
Gary, where can folks follow Tiger's work online and follow the journey and the research you guys do and possibly even become a member and get involved? Where can we all do that?
Yeah, it's pretty easy online. It's just www.tigher, which is a really weird way to spell Tiger, but it sounds better than Tigger. So again, www.tigher.org. You go to that webpage, the first thing you're going to see is the Earhart Project icon. Click on that, and you're there. It also provides you with the opportunity to become involved as a member. Whether you're participating in expeditions or not is up to you. It gives you the opportunity to become schooled in aviation archaeology, including some field schools that Tiger does. That is really the best way. I guess it's a more direct way to get involved.
Gary, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks very much, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast.
Join us next week as we welcome project guest and author Heidi Greco to the show. Thanks for listening.